Technorama episode 600, the big 600. Hey, welcome to Technorama. This is the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If you are joining us for the first time, where you been? Really? Come on. This is... Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
There's prerequisites here. You have to go back and start at 100 and catch up.
But you only have to listen to every 17th episode.
Those are the good ones. All the odd numbers, even numbers. How'd they go?
Don't try and figure it out. That's the other show. We're recording that this week.
Oh, yeah.
If you're returning, well, congratulations. Welcome. You've made it to 600 with us. And my name is Chuck Tomasi. With me, as always, is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I'm doing good. Still in sort of a quasi-quarantine state. Just hanging out.
My brain, like, quarantined out about 3 weeks ago.
I know. Hey, if you've been watching the show for the last couple of months, you'd see my hair growing slowly.
Hey. Yeah. Haircut. Yeah. Haircut.
How'd you get a haircut?
I'm not a shaggy mane anymore. It was a combined effort. Donna and I both took a few chops on it. And let me just say, curly hair is very forgiving.
Yeah, it looks like it.
It could be uneven and you wouldn't even know as long as you just smack that uneven part down.
Yeah, I was considering a buzz with the clippers, but I think I'm going to hold out for another week.
I was considering it too, but there's still a few more videos I need to record for work, and I don't want it to look drastically different. It's like, whoa, is this throwback to 2013?
Yeah. You can wear your work hat. Yeah.
No. We have some feedback. Should we start with the voicemail or the Facebook question?
Start with the voicemail.
Ooh, real voicemail. Let's play that music. Yeah,
yay,
mama.
Here we go.
Can I do karaoke to this?
Mailman, what's that?
Reach right out and pull one out.
Those letters, I love those letters. Let's find out what you've got to say.
Oh boy!
Mailman. Mail today.
I want to do a karaoke to that song.
You should.
If you can find the instrumental version, sure, go right ahead. We have voicemail from two people. Thank you very much. Let us start with Mike Wills.
Well, hello, Chuck and Craig.
Hello.
I thought I'd record you an actual audio clip, mostly because haven't done it in a long time.
Sounds good.
So this is Mike in Minnesota. I don't remember what my handle is. This is Mike Wills. longest podcast I've listened to.
Oh, he jumped ahead. That's
well,
our question.
Gets interesting.
Oh, yeah,
because
all right.
I cannot tell you 100% anymore because it's been so damn long. I think I started out initially with possibly Twit or some of the old, what's that book one that Michael Menage had?
Slide,
you know what I'm talking about?
Dragon Page cover
that
to cover.
One. And
all 16.
I think
of
you
them.
Guys were shortly. Around that same time frame.
Because we sent him our promo.
Still around, Twit, and you guys are really the two longest, and I think Security Now is a short second. Oh, there's Scott Sigler as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those four. Sigler, I know, is definitely one of the first ones. You guys, I'm pretty sure it was shortly thereafter. Twit is about that same time. I think Twit had 15 years as well.
Yeah, they started in spring of 15 as well.
Yeah, I think
or spring
it's
of 2005.
Kind of between one of those three. And I think we'll just call it a tie at this point because when I first discovered podcasting, I went hog wild and I grabbed about, I don't know, four or five different shows and grabbed a whole bunch of episodes.
That
I had
was
a
hog
long
wild.
Trip up north, about four.
There are only
four,
six.
I needed 5 hours by myself. So I listened to podcasts the entire way up and I got addicted. Let's look at my stats here real quick. So based on Pocket Cast, so obviously this is not, you know, the entire duration. Pocket Cast says I've listened for 121 days and 17 hours. So about, a third of a year?
Where are my stats?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest number right there. So 121 days and 17 hours worth of podcast listening.
A lot of podcasts.
That's a lot of podcasts.
Pocket Cast.
Now, we don't know how long that was because Pocket Cast hasn't been out since 2005, but...
Yeah.
I'm glad he's agreed. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to let you guys get back to your show, and thank you guys for the 15 years of entertainment. I'll just say I've been listening for 15 years. I don't think it's quite that long, but... that I've been listening. But hey, you know, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And that's why I'm Patreon 101.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And it's funny how 600 lined up almost with our 15-year anniversary exactly. So, you know, it's funny. As I was going through Podcasting for Dummies 4th edition, and we were talking about naming your files.
Yes.
And one of the examples in there is how we name the Technorama files.
Right.
And long about March of 2017, when we were writing the third edition 3 years ago, we had come up on episode 500. So guess what I changed today?
Yeah. Six. Yeah. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Wow. Get a whole bunch of money for changing stuff like that.
Yeah. And that was actually an important lesson. I thought I had a good beat on that, you know, when we were doing it originally. And then when we joined Farpoint Media, we got shoehorned into doing it a different way, which is fine, because I think as it was a better format, you know, the way we name them now. So
it made sense. They sort,
you know, I can sort the directory and they all look the same.
Well, we had a sorted method before. It just wasn't as elegant. I think we've always been putting a date in the file format somewhere. Anyway, let's get to our other voicemail from another patron.
Hello, Craig and Chuck. This is Amy Bowen of the Thread Snippings podcast, and Amy talks about stuff at ameliabowen.com.
Oops, too soon.
I am calling to say congratulations on your 600th show. That is really quite an achievement, and this must be one of the longest-running podcasts that's still been going. 600 episodes and 15 years is definitely something to celebrate, and I had to get a voicemail in and be a part of it.
Thank you.
One or both of you, or if you were there at the last Dragon Con when we did Dungeons & Dragons, you were on my 100th episode of Amy Talks About Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really good to see you. Don't know when we're going to see each other again, but I'm going to keep holding out hope that we are going to see each other again. And here's to many, many more years of great podcasting. Thanks for all the great content, and I'm proud to be a listener and a Patreon patron. 101.
All right, awesome. She is so articulate that Google Translate had an easy time translating. That wasn't nearly as funny as some of the other ones because she's so clear in the way.
Yeah.
The only thing that it screwed up at the end was, and I'm proud to be a listener and Patreon patron, 101 a.m. Like, that was the timestamp. It was 101 a.m. And I was listening close. Go, what's at the end? No, she just said 101. I don't know where it came up with the time of 101 a.m., 1:01. Okay, Google Translate, you have your fun. We'll have ours.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
I know we both certainly appreciate it.
And we don't know if there's going to be a Dragon Con thing. It's looking like it may not, but we're holding out hope as well.
We'll see it. And you know what? We will see each other again.
Yes. That part is, that's a given. That's a given. All right. Let us back up to our question of the week, which is, what is the podcast that you've been subscribed to the longest?
There are still a number of podcasts that started around the same time frame we did, maybe a little earlier. They're still going. So we're not alone, but certainly we're in the top few.
I know a number of them that responded are podcasters still going. So that's pretty awesome, too. Joel Harper says, probably Comedy Bang Bang or Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Mark Blackburn says, it really has been Technorama. After all you taught us, yours is the first pod I started listening to. I'm guessing that was 10 years ago now. He probably got started when I went out there in 2009 for the National Park Service. Weber Baker says, Technorama. But after that, I'd have to say the Britain Yankee. Wow.
I think of course.
2007, which seems really long now. MacBreak Weekly and Security Now from David Everson. Myron Dupler says, Scott Sigler, Kevin Devon. Where one of my first podcasts that I started listening to before we were podcasting, Craig and I were listening to Kevin. I'm still subscribed to In the Trenches, but it's been oddly quiet. Dude.
Well, whose fault is that? I used to contribute to his show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had fun with that one. That was a good one for IT admins. Billy Flynn says, technically mine, Geek Radio Daily. There you go. Now people are plugging their own. Mary from Church says, Your Move by Andy Stanley. Nancy, old high school friend Nancy, says, This American Life. Glenn Bradley, whom we met on the Star Trek crew, says, Waking Up with Sam Harris. Thank you very much. Taryn Roberts, Big O and Dukes. Never heard of that one. Here's some new ones, people, if you want to check them out. People are cross-promoting here. Rob Osden says, Not sure which one came first, Coverville or Evil Genius Chronicles. Technically, Evil Genius came first, but I don't know which one you subscribed to first.
I can tell you that Dave's podcast is one I've been subscribed to the whole time, and that was the first one I ever.
Could have even been Bitterest Pill or Verge of the Fringe. Wow, we are bringing up some old names here.
Yeah.
Donald says Scott Sigler. Rick Stringer says Mac Geek Gab. Wow. You may not be able to find many of these anymore. Some don't exist, but many of them do. I think Smodcast, Slice of Sci-Fi, and Winging It led me to a lot of pods. Geologic Podcast with George Robb. Sigler, T and Pip, Metamore City, etc. You know what's funny is a lot of these are still mentioned in the Dummies book.
Oh, yeah.
I was just coming across some of these, like Metamore City. I haven't heard that since, this afternoon. Ralph Wengler says, technically Deadpan for podcast actively updating its tie between Geologic Podcast and Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Amy says, very first one I ever subscribed to, which I re-added when I got my latest iPod Touch, was Radio Free Burrito with, who hosted that one, Craig?
Will Wheaton.
That's right.
Will Wheaton.
Just added a new RFB Presents episode today after 2 years on hiatus. Garrett says Security Now. Mary Beth says it's either Marketplace, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or This American Life. Someone's been listening to NPR. Thank you very much. Julio from Tijuana says it's either Scott Sigler or Richard Vobes. That's how I met Julio, was through Vobes.
Oh, yeah.
Chris Christensen says MacCast. Related to Adam? Could be a coincidence.
Yeah.
JT Shays goes for Sigler, Escape Pod Geologic. Clinton Alvord says, not his own. Clinton says, Window to the Magic. To which Gary Lindros replied, Escape Pod. That was Stephen Ely, who did that podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Hamilton also says, Window to the Magic. Grant Pachoco, guess what he says?
Radio Adventures of Dr. Floyd.
That's
of course.
Right. And he says, what? I had to make sure the feed worked.
Yeah.
That's why he was listening to his own show. Yorga says, Chuck Chat Technorama, unless you count Slacker Astronomy into Astronomy Cast, then that one wins. That's how I met Yorga, was through Slacker. Back when we couldn't pronounce his name. We thought he was Mexican.
Well, remember Yorga's dad used to be a listener as well.
Yes, he did. All right. You check your answers. What do you got?
Well, I got a few. Mike Will says, I sent you guys an audio answer. Did you get it?
No.
Yes, we did. No. We just played it.
No.
No, we did. Rob Reel says, Fear the Boot, a role-playing playing advice podcast.
Okay.
And he's listened to them since 2008. Britt Helms Sr. says, Daily Audio Bible, followed by The Tech Guy. And, of course, Derek Howard listens to the Evil Genius Chronicles.
Of course, yeah. That's how we know Derek.
Yep.
Is that it? Derek.
And then, let's go to the
Technorama page. We got Steve Cody. He says, putting my answer in the right place. Technorama is second on my list. Well, came in second again.
Thanks.
I started listening to This Week in Tech in 2005 and Technorama sometime after that. I think we actually, that's the way we started up chronologically, although there is legacy that goes back further than that. So I have been podcasting longer than Leo Laporte. I don't remember the first episode I listened to, but my oldest email to you guys is from, I was emailing about the ads in my Gmail that were related to the content of the emails I was reading. I always loved the show and can't count the number of times I've been on a plane getting ready to take off, hearing Craig say, unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. I love it. You know, I never thought about that on a plane. That was probably not the smartest thing to do.
I'm supposed to put them on, but they're telling me to take them off.
If you don't know, I'll play the old intro for you sometime. Megan says, Larry Mantle and Fresh Air from my local public radio station, KPCC. The host announced that this radio show could be downloaded as a podcast. That's the way they used to say it in the old days. So that it could be more portable. That was the first time this new mom had heard of the word podcast, and it gave me the freedom to go out into the world with my infant and not chained to my radio, where I was just desperate to hear other humans talking to each other. That infant is in high school now. Yes, they all grow up. Harrison did that too, and now Harrison's graduating.
He did. He graduated, finished up this week. Oh, so, yes.
My.
Hey, by the way, when was the first time you ever heard the word podcast?
I first heard it on a show called Tech Talk with Ken Rakowski and Jeff Yablon. It was on, I think it was the Real Player on an old NT laptop.
I hadn't thought about Real Player in a while.
I was listening to the Real Player and they had some channel buttons on there and one of them was Tech Talk and I'd listen to that regularly. It was a good news story. Ken is still around. He's still doing a podcast. And a newsletter and a whole bunch of other stuff. And he was saying something to the effect that those people over at Engadget really have this podcast thing down. And I went, this what? So I searched for it and I went to Engadget and they had basic instructions on how to get your first podcast client and where you could go for what was then a really feeble directory of podcasts. And I think I subscribed to Geek News Central, In the Trenches, Steve Holden had one or two, Tech Rag Tearouts, and something else. I can't remember what it was. I think he had two at the time, or came up with another one later. And, MacCast was in there. So there were a number of them that I listened to. That was September, October of 2004. And I listened to them and I went, hey, I could do that eventually.
Yeah. I know the first time I saw it, I think I looked for the article. I just can't find it, but I thought it was on Slashdot. I remember seeing, I was reading something and I read by the word podcast and I backed up and said, wait a minute, what's that? And it was just, it was one of those words that does grab your attention, especially if you haven't seen it the first time. And I was like, okay, what in the heck is a podcast? So I went, I started searching around. I may have run into that same Engadget article. I don't remember. But I saw some instructions on how to listen to podcasts or download them, which led me to the Daily Source Code.
Daily Source Code was one of them as well. Yeah, which was misleading because it wasn't always about Source Code.
I guess it was called that at Reddit first. Anyway, so I listened to him, and the first podcast or the first episode I'm listening to, he was talking about this other guy podcasting down in South Carolina. I went, oh. So I went and listened to, I don't think he mentioned that. He mentioned Dave Slusher. The Iwo Genus Chronicles. And I went and listened to that. And Dave was talking about taking a nice walk out in the sun in Conway, South Carolina. And that blew my mind because I'm thinking, through Conway. Conway is like on the way to the beach. I've been through it a million times to go travel to the beach. I know exactly. It's in my backyard. So and that's kind of led me to Kevin Devin and then all this other craziness, including you. So,
yeah. Just think, a couple of left turns instead of right turns, and we didn't be in a different place in our lives.
I know. We can only hope.
A lot of great people commenting in on the chat room. Yeah, I got it. Craig Glasner says 10010110, which is the title for a Star Trek episode, the one with the binars on it.
Yeah,
don't think that one got by us. We also do the topic is Trek at the topic is Trek. 600.com. Haha.
Right.
What is 600 in binary? Well, in hex, it's something greater than 200. Because 512 is 200 hex. Anyway, yeah. Let us move on. Because I think we've exhausted this one. Thank you for everybody who sent in comments and sharing your long-term podcast loves. And we appreciate that you have been listening to this one and participated on Facebook as well. Let's go to, what is this other episode 600 post you got here, Craig? I didn't see you sneak that in.
There was a couple of posts in there, comments about where I made the little collage.
You made that collage.
There was a couple of comments on there I thought was worth mentioning.
Go right ahead.
So, it's really Steve Cody had said this, basically the same thing. I think it's the same post, earlier, about the question of the week. Anyway, he says, he's looking back at his email. Mike Wills, congratulations. I might not have been there in the beginning, but I was there in the early days. I invited him to go listen from the beginnings. You know.
If you can find the old ones, some of them aren't around anymore. And Keith Lane sent us this. Happy anniversary. All right, it goes on for a minute and a half, you know, from the Flintstones where they just keep singing. It's like the song that never ends.
I love that. It's funny.
Thank you.
Thanks, Keith.
Let's wrap up our voicemail and we will move on to. Yes. You know what follows
into
the voicemail?
The Craig chopping up name segment.
If that's what we're going to call it, then let's do it. Craig chopping up name segment for May 13, 2020. This is the 134th day of the year in the Craigorian calendar. There are RS-232 days remaining in 2020. I'm just going to have as much fun as possible with this. It was on this date in 1787 that Captain Arthur Phillip left Portsmouth, England, with 11 ships full of convicts, called the First Fleet, to establish a penal colony in Australia. He said colony.
Yeah. It was 159 years ago today that the Great Comet of 1861 was discovered by John Tubbett of Windsor, New South Wales, Austria.
Australia.
Oh, is there an L in there? Okay.
There's no New South Wales in Austria.
I don't know why I didn't see the L. I just saw Austria. I was like, okay.
And 2 weeks later, there was the mediocre comet that nobody really cared about. It was also on this date in 1880 in Menlo Park, New Jersey. Thomas Edison performed the first test of his electric railway. I'm going to make a model train.
And on May 13th, 1958, Ben Carlin became the first and only person to circumnavigate the world by amphibious vehicle, having traveled over 17,000 kilometers, which is about 11,000 miles for you people in the U.S., by sea, and 62,000 kilometers, which is 39,000 miles in the for you people in the U.S., by land during a 10-year journey.
10 years? Wow. What did he take? Years. One of those ducks from the Wisconsin Dells? How do you go...
That was when the Spanish flu was floating around. He was on a cruise ship and they couldn't find a port to.
You have to stay out there. It was also on this date in 1995 that Alison Hargraves, a 33-year-old British mother, became the first woman to conquer Everest without oxygen or the help of a Sherpa. Wow.
I don't need you, Sherpas.
Why? Yeah, I don't need a stupid Sherpa.
I can do this without oxygen. Dumb old oxygen. Who needs that?
Who needs that?
Happy birthday.
A chair and this lamp and this.
Happy birthday goes out in this date to French mathematician, astronomer, and geophysicist. What language were we in? French. So this would be Alexis Clairaut, born on this date in 1713. Yeah, sure, we'll go with Alexis Clairaut.
Yeah. Born May 13th, 1857, Indian English physician and mathematician, Nobel Prize laureate, Ronald Ross.
Inga Lehmann, the Danish seismologist and geophysicist, was born on that same date in 1888.
And Spanish mathematician, academic, and astronomer, Antonia Ferran Morarius, was born 106 years ago today.
And it wouldn't have been the Star Wars holiday special without this special woman, born May 13th, 1922, American actress and singer, singer B. Arthur.
Yeah, there's evidence that her singing in that. Anyway, Trevor Bayliss, the English inventor, invented the wind-up radio, was born 83 years ago today.
Richie Valens, the American singer, songwriter, and guitarist, was born on the same date in 1941.
An American singer, songwriter, pianist, and producer, Stevie Wonder is 70 today.
It can see clearly now. I can't even remember. Don't give me a... Oh, I know.
See clearly
there's
now?
Hmm?
That's not the right... He didn't do that song.
No, what song did Stevie do?
You name it. I mean, there's a bunch of them, not that one.
Yeah, I can hear about three of them, but I can't put my finger on any of them because this music in the background is distracting me.
Me too. Go ahead.
American electrical engineer Ruth A. David, born on this date in 1953.
And American comedian, talk show host Stephen Colbert is 56 today.
Hey, you didn't say Colbert.
I can, Colbert.
Listener birthdays this week include May 13th through 22nd. We have two of them. May 14th is JPCJ. That looks like something I'd pull off a license plate. And
well, that's who is in charge of the parade of the Dragon Con.
Is it JP or CJ? We have friends JP. With JP and CJ. This is probably their love
that's
child.
Right.
Who knows? And May 22nd is Tim Elliott, longtime listener. There you go. That's the way it was on this day in history for May 13th, 2020. And goodbye, band.
Later.
If you want to get on the birthday calendar, you know what to do. There's a link at the bottom. You can get right there and go get your name on there. It's called chuckchat.com/wiki. Have we thought of a Stevie Wonder song yet?
Huh? Are we supposed to?
Nah, I don't know. We're not getting any better at this. Let's drop that potato while it's cold.
Isn't she lovely? Superstition, of course. I wish.
Yeah, we're getting some requests in the
higher
chat.
Higher ground. Yeah. Huh?
You Googled it.
I don't know why my mind was blank on the... I love those songs, especially Superstition.
Sir Duke. Why couldn't I think of that one?
Yeah.
Music is a world within itself. Okay. I don't have my dark glasses on, so I can't do that one. Now you're going to have me start trying to sing those for karaoke. I might be able to do a Stevie Wonder.
Is that Donna whistling back there?
Donna is humming in the background, but you can't hear her.
Oh, so she's on the podcast finally.
Yeah.
Good news, anyone?
Well, it might be good news. We may have just found the next great lighting material, not lightning material. And did I forget to put the right link?
Bottle.
I forgot to put the right link in there. Dagnabbit. I thought we fixed this already.
Oh. You know what?
It only goes to the top page of Yahoo. Okay. You fix that. I'll go that one. Yeah. You can have this lighting material one back. It's a long article, though. We're not going to have a chance to read all that one. Okay. Right. Let's go on to the second one while Craig is fixing that one. How the ballpoint pen killed cursive. This is an interesting story. Recently, Bic launched a campaign to save handwriting named Fight for Your Right to Party. No, right as in W-R-I-T-E. And it includes a pledge to encourage the act of handwriting in a pledge taker's home and community and emphasizes putting more of the company's ballpoints into classrooms. Now, this author writes, as a teacher, I couldn't help but wonder how anyone could think there's a shortage. I find ballpoint pens all over the place, on classroom floors, behind desks, dozens of castaways collected in cups on every teacher's desk.
Couches?
What's that?
Or couches?
You find pens in your couches?
Not mine, but yes. I've seen plenty of pens in a couch.
They're so ubiquitous that the word ballpoint is rarely used. They're just pens. But despite its popularity, the ballpoint pen is relatively new in the history of handwriting, and its influence on popular handwriting is more complicated than the Bic campaign would imply. The creation story of the ballpoint pen tends to highlight a few key individuals. Most notably are the Hungarian journalist Laszlo Biro, who is credited for inventing it, but as with most stories of individual genius, this take obscures a much longer history of iterative engineering and marketing success. In fact, Biro wasn't the first to develop the idea. The ballpoint pen was originally patented in 1888 by an American leather tanner named John Loud, But his idea never went any further. Over the next few decades, dozens of other patents, and I'm saying that for our Canadian friends.
Patents?
Right. Were issued, it's like project, for pens that used a ballpoint tip of some kind, but none of them made it to market.
Really?
These earlier pens failed not in their mechanical design, but in their choice of ink. The ink used in a fountain pen, the ballpoint's predecessor, is thinner to facilitate better flow through its nib. But that thinner ink inside the ballpoint pen and you'll end up with a leaky mess. Ink is where Laszlo Brio, working with his chemist brother Grigory, wow, great spellings on these things, made some crucial changes. They experimented with thicker, quick-drying ink, starting with the ink used in newspaper presses. Eventually, they refined both the ink and the ball tip to create a pen that didn't leak badly. I love that.
Badly.
This
occasionally it does. I've had that happen before.
Oh, yeah. Where you wind up with a blue shirt, blue pocket, and all your laundry's ruined.
You got red on you. Got
to remember, this was an era in which the pen could be a huge hit because it only leaked sometimes. The bureaus lived in a troublesome time, however. The Hungarian author Grigory Moldova writes in his book, Ballpoint, about Laszlo's flight from Europe to Argentina to avoid Nazi persecution. While his business deals in Europe were in disarray, he patented the design in Argentina in 1943 and began production. His big break came later that year when the British Air Force, in search of a pen that would write at high altitudes, purchased 30,000 of them. Soon, patents were filed and sold to various companies in Europe and North America, and the ballpoint pen began to spread across the world. So, lots of great story in here. Cool stuff.
That's pretty amazing because you think how ubiquitous a ballpoint pen, or I would say how big of an impact it's had.
I have several around here, yes.
I think it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. You know what I carried over? This is a weird trait, and I don't know why I do it, but I can't seem to stop. When I write with pencils, you know, you sharpen the pencil, and if you keep writing on the same surface, it'll eventually flatten. So you kind of give it a little turn as you write.
Right. Yeah.
I do that with pens. There's no good reason for it, but it's just kind of a writing habit. I'll write a few words and I'll turn it a little bit. And the problem comes in when you get the ballpoint pens that open and close with a twist, because I'll be writing and then all of a sudden the tip will disappear. I twisted it.
I wonder.
His pen's broke.
Yeah. The point of the article, and I missed it, was how it killed, the ballpoint pen killed cursive.
It's a long article and it didn't quite get there.
Yeah, it didn't. But do you still write in cursive?
No, I discovered that you don't have to.
You know, I don't know why I always thought it was important, like it was the adult thing to do, or maybe just the way you were supposed to sign checks and stuff like that. But yeah, it was kind of almost like a realization. It's like, oh, I've been lied to my whole life. I have to do this.
Well, until you get to be about 8 or 10 years old, you can't read cursive. So parents could use it as a code. You can't quite read it. Right. So that might be where you think of. And then, of course, the checks, when you're writing out checks and you write the letters,
still write the
100 and 50 and 00, you know, 100s. And then you put in that long line across the rest. You know what that's called? That's a sniglet. It actually has a name, the mega negabar. That's so somebody doesn't slip in like extra decimals on you.
Right. Well, I know that. I know why it's there. I didn't know what it was called, but yes.
Yes. Okay. If you read Rich Hall's Sniglets book, it's the mega negabar. Anyway, once I found out you don't have to cursive for that anymore, I started printing. And that was like well into my 30s. I went, really? That's the end of my cursive career, except for my signature. That's the only thing that's even, closely resembles cursive. It's more a bunch of squiggles at this point.
Yeah. I don't know why was that a thing? Why was it a thing to begin with?
Because you can't do a signature without cursive. Can you see somebody printing their name?
I do. Harrison does.
When he signs a legal document or a driver's license or something, he prints it?
Sure. Yes.
No. That doesn't work.
It's the same. Why doesn't it?
you might as well just write an X.
Well, I mean, it's got its name. Yeah,
it's too easy to forge if you just printed. That'd be my argument against it.
I disagree. I think you're still going to. Yeah, I mean, you could forge them anything. So I think it's any harder or less hard.
Well, a lot of the digital readers, when you sign something, they're not only detecting the lines, like a pattern, but they're also detecting pressure and speed, which is even harder to forge. I mean, if I practiced, I could probably write your name, but I wouldn't write it in the same pressure and sensitivity and speed as you would.
I've seen Kim could go to the grocery store and, well, I don't think they really do it so much anymore, but, you know, they make you sign the thing and she would just put a squiggly line.
Yeah.
Nobody ever said anything.
That's pretty much what my signature's turned into is this squiggly line.
You know, just, I'm like, that doesn't even look like what your name.
All right. Let's go on to this great lighting that you found.
So I updated the lighting.
Are they boiling fireflies now?
Yes, milking absolutely. Them? The tears of fireflies. So researchers in Switzerland have found a new organic light emitting diode, OLED, material that can scale the technology up inexpensively light entire rooms and homes for the first time. The results come from the new arrangement of copper electrons, CUPPCPPP, CUPPCP.
That's what I said when I gave up that drug. CUPCP.
Yeah, that's right. CUP. And replaces the more costly precious metal diodes. So, in the next line, let's have some alphabet soup and learn about OLEDs.
Dr. Seuss time.
That's right. So OLEDs are natural descendants of the natural light emitting diode, LEDs, technology. About 10 years ago, plasma LEDs, TVs, competed head-to-head with different categories, and plasma was the clear winner. But plasma TVs represented a proprietary technology that only worked for certain large sizes and in bright light. They weren't able to compete. LEDs, meanwhile, had been improving, but still inferior black levels that looked garish and unbelievable. Unbelievable in the dark. And I remember that. I remember having a TV and you could still see it, kind of almost like gray, like illuminated gray almost. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so enter the OLED TVs, which married the improved, improved both technologies. Instead of bright backlight of the LED TV, OLEDs have their own light. That means deeper, truer blacks, but without the brightness trade-offs associated with plasma. Plus, OLED had better image quality and contrast. And since OLED pixels are individually controlled, they're also fast to change color. That's important for things like gaming or watching sports or action movies.
Or Technorama.
Yeah, that's right. Where you technically, or you would consistently ghosting, you know, when you see an action film. But anyway, so phosphorescent LEDs change the physics. They reach internal quantum efficiencies of up to 100%. They say that because of the PHOLEDs require costly precious metals like iridium, ruthenium, and palladium.
Platinum,
excuse me.
We got to work on your periodic table.
My eyes are getting tired today. PHOLEDs are PHOLEDs, like, they're not real.
No, PHOLEDs are mostly in it's made out of that Vietnamese soup.
That's right.
They're PHOLEDs.
Oh, let's just make a TV out of this. Yeah. Anyway, so the secret to the Swiss's team's new material is a behavior called thermally activated delayed fluorescence, or TADF. Like supercooled superconductor or hot nuclear reactor, these TADF OLEDs must get a certain temperature before they can operate as designed, and they use a supply of outside energy to get that temperature. Let's see. Several years ago, researchers began to make diodes using copper in a similar excited state on the way the precious metals worked in PHOLEDs. The results were phenomenal. A remarkable photoluminance quantum yield greater than
careful, 99%. Don't hurt yourself.
What's that? Yeah, I know. Greater than 99% and was recently achieved for with such materials. Anyway, so that's pretty cool.
Yay. Does that mean TVs are going to get cheaper? Because it sounded like they could make these things easy. Does that mean it's going to be cheaper?
No. You know, every time they come out with a new TV with a new technology, it always costs like $10,000.
I'm going to have to replace all the LED lights in the studio again.
Oh, man. Donna, more money.
Wait, we have Patreon people for that.
What?
We have Patreon people for that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Replace our LEDs.
All right. Since we're in the world of small, we're going to talk about an atom-sized machine. Because if you wanted to build an atom-sized machine, you would need...
Oh. So you're going to skip over the photographer takes clearest photo mechanic. Of the moon.
What? Did I? Oh, yep, yeah, I did. Okay. Do you want to do the machine or you want the moon?
I got the moon. I'll do this one too.
Okay.
So a photographer has captured a mesmerizingly clear photo of the moon's craters.
Yes, he has.
By combining its phases into one picture. So Andrew McCarthy, not the actor, stacked thousands of pictures together over moon phases to show the surface of an incredible clarity. He captured his images on the lunar at the lunar terminator, the line between the light and the dark side of the moon, to give him great clarity and contrast. Posting on Instagram, the California-based astrophotographer described the snap, titled "All Terminator," as an impossible scene. So McCarthy said, "From 2 weeks of images of the waxing moon, I took the section of picture that was the most that has the most contrast right before the lunar terminator, where the shadows are the longest, aligning and blending them to show the rich texture across the entire surface. This was exhausting to say the least, namely because the moon doesn't line up day over day. So each image had to be mapped to a 3D sphere and adjusted to make sure each image is aligned." Wow. The sun is closer to the horizon than the terminator, creating long shadows that give the surface a 3D appearance. Now, if you go look at this picture, it is incredible.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's almost like doing HDR photography. That's kind of what I would equate it. You know,
yeah, it's got really high contrast between the flatter parts, the Mare, and the cratered parts. It just that would be really disappointing if you went click, 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 click. I got all these images over the last 2 weeks. Oh, crap, they don't line up.
I'm not seeing it on here, but there was a large version of this picture. I'll see if I can find it and put it in the show notes. But yeah, you have to go take a look at it because it was pretty fascinating.
Amazing. And he did that with just, his backyard telescope? How come nobody thought of this before?
Well, it said astrophotographer, so I'm not sure what he was using exactly. But I know a guy, I've talked about it before. I know a guy had like an $80,000 telescope in his backyard. It's a full observatory. It's pretty amazing.
That's not uncommon. There are lots of people that have those. All right. Yeah. What is uncommon? Let's get back to our story about if you want to build an atom-sized machine, you need a quantum mechanic. Oh, that just...
And some tweezers. Quantum mechanic.
Experiments with single-atom device helps researchers understand what quantum effects will come into play when machinery shrinks to the atomic scale. Here's a new chapter in the story of miniaturization of machines. Researchers in a laboratory in Singapore have shown that a single atom can function as either an engine or a fridge. Okay. Such a device could be engineered into future computers and fuel cells to control energy flows. Quote, "Think about how your computer or laptop has a lot of things inside it that heat up. Today, you cool that with a fan that blows air. In nanomachines or quantum computers, small devices that could do cooling could be something useful," says Dario Paletti of the Singapore University of Technology and Design. "This work gives new insight into the mechanics of such devices. The work is a collaboration involving researchers at the Center for Quantum Technologies and Department of Physics at the National University of Singapore. SUTD and University of Augsburg in Germany, the results were published in a peer-reviewed journal, NPJ Quantum Information, on the 1st of May. Engines and refrigerators are both machines described by thermodynamics, a branch of science that tells us how energy moves within a system and how we can extract useful work. A classical engine turns energy into useful work. A refrigerator does work to transfer heat, reducing the local temperature. They are, in some senses, opposites. Yeah, I guess you could say that, in some sense. People have made small heat engines before using a single atom, a single molecule, and defects in a diamond. A key difference about this device is that it shows quantumness. Is that a word? Quantumness.
Yeah, it is now.
In its action. Quote, we want to understand how we can build thermodynamic devices with just a few atoms. The physics is not well understood, especially to this listener.
Yeah.
So our work is important to know what is possible, says Manas Mukherjee, a principal investigator at CQT NUS, who led, speaking of alphabet soup from the last article. All right. We are not going to read this entire article because it is pretty long and has lots of big words that we can't pronounce, but it's kind of interesting that they're getting into this really small atomic thing to make an engine. That's pretty wild. This is mind-blowing. It'd be interesting to see how it manifests itself in the next few years.
I'm curious how they use it.
Right. All right. Now, clearly, our current president... has not watched Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Because that's the first thing I saw when I heard this on Reuters. I was watching TV one day, and it said, the Trump administration is drafting a legal blueprint for mining the moon under a new U.S.-sponsored international agreement called the Artemis Accords. People familiar with the proposed pact told Reuters, the agreement would be the latest effort to cultivate allies around NASA's plan to put humans in space stations on the moon within the next decade, and comes as a civilian space agency plays a growing role in implementing American foreign policy. The draft pact has not been formally shared with U.S. allies yet. Well, it's in the news, so it probably has been. I mean, they know of it. They probably haven't seen the whole thing. So the Trump administration and other spacefaring countries see the moon as a key strategic asset in outer space. Was it? I know there's a thing in here a little bit later because there's, I thought there was some agreement in the 60s that said no one can claim the moon, or am I thinking of Antarctica?
I know it's Antarctica because they have.
Yeah, we have like a whole bunch of countries with little stations all over Antarctica. So, no, yeah. We didn't claim anything except this, you know, 20 by 20 plot for our station. But I thought the moon was under the same kind of no claims management up there.
I thought so, too.
The United States is a member of the 1967 Outer Space Treaty and sees, quote, safety zones as an implementation of one of its highly debated articles. It states that celestial bodies and the moon are, quote, not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty by means of the use of or occupation or by any other means. So if we're going to start up mining up there, whose mine is it? Who gets the raw materials? What happens when
I'll tell you
it
scares me.
It explodes.
Yeah, it explodes. What scares me is if you take enough material off the moon, at what point does it change the way things work here on Earth?
My guess is it's going to be so minuscule, Craig. You're going to have to take a lot of material for a very, very long time. And as it
just
stands
saying,
right now,
just saying,
the moon is moving away from us very slowly. I can't remember the exact figure. I thought it was something about centimeters a year or a couple of centimeters every 100 years. It was something very slowly, but it is moving away and eventually it will go out. So solar eclipses, total solar eclipses only happen right now. But say in a million years, there won't be, they'll just be annular solar eclipses. So,
right. I don't know. I know it sounds a little weird. I'm just thinking, take enough material off the moon. I mean, I don't know.
I'm kind of thinking this one isn't going to fly. We're just letting you know. I'm guessing this was
It's one thing to bring a rock back, but I mean, it's one thing to start removing material from it all. Maybe I'm just being naive about it. I don't know.
The total mass of the moon versus how much you could actually remove viably by rockets or some other means is going to be so negligible, Craig.
So you're for this?
Huh? I'm not saying I'm for it. I'm just saying it won't matter.
Okay.
It would be like, how many skin cells do you lose every year?
Oh, well.
No. Okay. Lots more than the moon would lose in mining materials. Okay, those are our five stories.
They're going to start. You know what's going to happen? They're going to start. Yeah. They remove their first truckload off the moon, and it's going to start wobbling.
It turns upside down.
Yeah. Hey, now it'll be like a balloon.
If they take enough off, it won't be tidally locked, and it'll start. We'll get to see the other side.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you put the amusement park on the other side.
Yeah.
Okay.
They'll be telling us the Earth's not flat.
We're getting to the end of this show, and we appreciate everybody who's joined us. We are here Sunday nights at 9:30 Eastern Time. Hope to see you there. Set your alarm clock. Set your whatever it is so you can get those notifications. Go to the Technorama page on Facebook. Subscribe, and we will see you there. What you looking at? Patrons. We're getting there. Patrons coming up. Let's do the patrons real quick because we had a record-breaking month in April, and we thank you. Our expenses continue with hosting, double hosting right now. We're not done with the transition yet. We're working on it.
And almost there.
Many other things. There's lots of things going on our expenses. Afonic to do the post-production on this show. Thank you very much for that. And you have helped immensely, plus planning for future surprises, because, you know, it's technology and surprise. Suddenly software doesn't work when the operating system gets upgraded or something crazy like that.
We've made a career out of surprises.
This whole show is one big surprise.
Yeah. Oh, whoa. We've been podcasting for 15 years. Whoa.
When is anything going to stabilize?
When did that happen?
Thank you, Alexis Duran and Amber Elstad, Amy Bowen, Evner Braverman, Ben Vaughn, Brian Brown. These are names we try not to screw up too much.
Brian Braun.
Brian Braun.
Braun.
Chris MC, Dandy Man Coyer, Danny Mortensen, Dean Jensen, Denise Inglis. Thank you, Gary Lindros, Harold McKinstry, John Clifford. Thank you, John Noble and Jorga Schrauen. Thank you, Christina. Very much thank you to Kyle Nishioka, one of our oldest listeners around. Leon, Mark Kilfoyle, Mike Wills. We heard from him earlier as well. Night Gig Studios, Saturday Morning Media, Stephen Wetchy, and Steve Therian. Much appreciated. You guys really, really keep the show going. We just show up and read some funny stories.
Yeah, right.
Or sometimes it's real news. You never know. It's deposited. The April check is in the bank. I don't think it's collecting any interest, but it's not doing anyone any harm either.
We got a penny.
And we have enough to pay our hosting one more time as we go forward. And that, my friends, is a really, really good feeling. So out with the stormtroopers, whatever it was. You can be a patron and get your name enshrined on the show for as little as $1 a show over at patreon.com/technoramapodcast. If you forget, you can always go over to chuckchat.com, click on the Technorama link, and I'm sure there's a Patreon badge somewhere on that site.
Look, there's three empty cells. One of them can be yours.
Scott, Craig's OCD is kicking in again.
Yeah. It's an odd number here.
We need to fill out this 4x something table. So thank you again. I know this is crazy times for everybody, and we really appreciate it. We will continue to bring the show as long as possible because we just don't know when to stop.
That's right.
Let's go into the Geek Library. Oh, I forgot to put in a show for Shut Up and Hand Me the Remote. But we'll get that next time. We do have another show to talk about. But in this timeline, this alternate reality, which we call Technorama, is the Geek Library. Would you go ahead and do the honors?
Yeah, I'll go over this. So, one of my friends, actually a guy I work with, he was listening to some punk music the other day, you know, while he was coding. And I was like, punk, I hadn't listened to punk in a long time. So I started listening to some, and some of it was familiar, some of it was new on Spotify. And then I saw this article. So if you're into punk, apparently there's a lot of it right here. So the legendary punk label Discord Records has its entire catalog online for free. So did you know that the entire 40-year catalog of the punk rock label of note Discord is available on Bandcamp for free streaming? While free, they're hoping that listeners will download the music to support the artist. Bandcamp is waiving their sales fees for certain days on each month so that all of the money will go to the artist. The first of these days was May 1st. The initiative will also repeat on June 5th, July 3rd, and will last from noon to midnight PST on all three of those days. So while the foundations of punk music have multiple different influencers, seminal Washington, D.C. punk label Discord have always had their say. The independent label, co-owned by Ian McKay and Jeff Nelson, founded the company in 1980 in order to release Minor Disturbance by the Teen Idols. From there, Discord focused on nationwide network of underground bands and continued to spearhead the punk music movement, excuse me, with their uncompromising approach to the music industry. It says, we don't use contracts, lawyers, or any kind of those things, McKay once commented on the ethos of Discord Records. We are partners. They make music. We make the records. Nielsen, echoing McKay's sentiment, added, from the beginning of the label, people have said that the way we do things is unsustainable, unrealistic, and idealistic. And we are, and we are just dreaming. Well, the dream is now 35 years old, so they can go blank themselves. So there you go. Go check it out. There's a lot of music in there. And I found a few that were okay. You know, I'm just kind of getting my feet wet in some of the punk scene. I it's funny, as I pulled up Spotify and I started playing some punk music and it's like, okay, I know that. I know that. And went, what is that? It was like a total top 40 song. I was like, I think Spotify screwed up.
Well, I remember when I was in school, the people who were really into punk would say, you didn't listen to any punk? And you go, yeah, I listened to The Clash. Like, oh, really? What? And don't say Rock the Casbah. You know, yeah. It's like, if it made it into the top 40, suddenly it was like on their blacklist. Like, well, come on, yeah. You got to have an introduction somewhere.
Well, I pulled up Spotify, I searched for punk, and it said essential punk. I said, well, let's start there. And I started listening to it, and I'm like, some of it was, you could tell, I was like, okay, yeah, I'm into this. I'm like, wait a minute, what the heck is that? That was on top 40. You know,
Air Supply.
Yeah. We built this city.
And yeah. Murray, what?
Yeah. So that's kind of funny.
All right, that brings us to the end. We have our question of the week for you, though. What movie sounds bad when you explain the plot, but it's actually really good? This is a harder question than we usually get, Craig.
I got to make you think.
Yeah.
We're going to up our game. We're at episode 600. We got to up our game, man.
I'm out.
You're out.
That's it for me.
Till next week. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, patrons.
Yeah. Enjoyed it while it lasted.
All right. We have enjoyed this very much, and we are going to enjoy talking to you again real soon. So if you want to get in contact with us like Amy or Mike did, Mike recorded a clip and sent it to us. Amy called our listener line at 707-530-2428, and we appreciate that very much. Thank you, Amy, and thank you, Mike, for giving us those voicemails. It's been a long time since we heard from you, dear listener, so it's nice to know the voicemail line still works. If you go back and you listen to things prior to about 2016, it's a different voice number. Don't use the old 206-222-2482. Yeah. Wow, I don't even want to remember that, but it came out.
Well, that's funny. There was a time when you could just repeat it in your sleep.
Well, it was so much easier to remember, actually, because we had that 222 in there. This is 707, like the old airplane. 530. Remember that for what it's worth. Anyway, 2428. Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama. And Craig, we missed it, but give us a binary high five.
All right, 101.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.